I appreciated Carl Vakencher's description of the seminary and its many gifts, among which I am sure he included himself. Death and resurrection as apocalyptic event. One, the inevitability of an apocalyptic theme. At the dawn of the third millennium, fanaticism, eschatology, and death was an inevitable theme for this symposium. 2000 is the best of all calendar possibilities, a new year, century, millennium. This homiletical privilege will be denied future generations of preachers. The downside is that calendar concerns in theology are an accommodation to the times and now an embarrassment. Millennium was judged the most useless word in the English language. Trendiness in religious matters is annoying. The New Testament writers pay no attention to such things. They were concerned with their message, not world events, or in this case, none events. When sermons say what everyone else says, the otherness of the gospel is lost. The December 21st, 1999 CBS 60 Minutes 2 defined the apocalypse as Christ's thousand-year reign on earth, which will begin when Christians are vaporized into heaven by the rapture. To arrive at this definition, the show's producers apparently combined the thousand-year reign with apocalypse, the alternate name for the book of Revelation, where this reign is predicted. Contemporary apocalypticism, as defined by Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth, involves three events: the establishment of the state of Israel as a state, the capture of Jerusalem, both of which have taken place, and the capture of the Temple Mount for its reconstruction. Whole morning was worth it just for this. I would suggest both Mr. Weinrich and Mr. Wendy that they just play ball in their own leagues. Establishment of an earthly Jewish kingdom was known during the Reformation and condemned by Augsburg Confession 17, as Mr. Rass previously mentioned. Most neo-evangelicals make the success of Israel an article of faith. The ascension narrative that Jesus would return in the same way in which he left has motivated some to prime the apocalyptic pump, apparently without success. Though Israel has allies in the likes of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, its military remains on alert to assure no one establishes the millennial kingdom with or without Jesus. Call this synergistic apocalypticism, but God fails to do the enthusiast's will. An apocalyptic event is an extraordinary apocalypse now. An apocalyptic event is an extraordinary act in nature or history in which God brings his final condemnation on unbelief into the present. Such events are in the near and not distant future and bring judgment upon those who have known and rejected the gospel. God's patience with unbelief has been exhausted. God's ordinariness, in which he approaches us in the preached word and the sacraments, is replaced by the extraordinariness of the apocalyptic, so that those who see these events are awestruck. Not every extraordinary natural or historical event is apocalyptic, but apocalyptic events are in every case extraordinary. Though apocalyptic events do not signal that God has written the world's final chapter they do spell finality for that generation. The time of grace has come and gone. Their kairos is over. An event predicted only for a distant future, which no person living then will experience, is not apocalyptic. Biblical apocalyptic events include the world's destruction by the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah's incendiary end, and Jerusalem's destruction in the 6th century BC by the Babylonians. These Old Testament apocalyptic themes or events appear in Jesus' preaching. Anyone not heeding his Sermon on the Mount faces a watery apocalypse. Capernaum faces Sodom's fate. A coming destruction is like the flood. His own death and resurrection will be an apocalyptic judgment against a generation which rejected him. Apocalyptic beyond law and gospel. In spite of the terrors instilled by apocalyptic preaching, which necessarily precede the events, apocalypticism is something beyond the law-gospel dichotomy. Missing is the note of hope, a virtue which the law implicitly promises in preparing for the gospel. The law's devastating diagnosis is not only preliminary to, but necessary for the solution provided in the gospel. Law is not God's retribution, leveling the field with sinners. Hence the statement, sinners in the hand of an angry God, is totally wrong. But an incision into the diseased soul to address the wretchedness of the human condition, to lay it bare for the gospel's saving balm. Even if no one is capable of taking advantage of the law's conditions, its preachment is an act of divine mercy in preparing for a better future in the gospel. It offers a second chance. The law tells us about ourselves, not about God. And the gospel tells us about the God who is love, loves the Son, and in loving the Son, loves the world. Apocalyptic preaching does not describe the human condition, but God's coming not in the mercy of the gospel, but in judgment against unbelief. Unlike the law, apocalyptic judgment is not God's universal condemnation of sin, but is carrying out of a divine verdict against particular rejections of the gospel. Apocalyptic events are divine retribution on those who see but do not perceive, and who hear but do not comprehend. Such acts hold out no promise of a future salvation. Flood waters engulf the world, fire reduces Sodom to ashes, and Jerusalem's stones are left in an unreconstructible disarray. In the apocalyptic event, there is no tomorrow for those who have rejected the gospel. Judgment against those who reject the gospel is as final as Noah's flood. By the sacramental rainbow, God pledges to spare the world from water, but not from destruction. Sodom and Gomorrah's destruction by celestial fire is a pledge of retribution against unbelievers. God's chosen people no longer inhabit Jerusalem's precincts. A remnant is saved, but nearly all are eternally condemned. In each of Matthew's 5 discourses, Jesus includes an absolute judgment on those hearers who refuse to believe him and his word. Jerusalem is Sodom, where Jesus was crucified, and it is Babylon, which persecutes God's saints. She is forever forsaken. The 5th section, apocalyptic motif in the Lutheran Confessions, for which we were more than amply prepared by Dr. Carl Lindbergh yesterday. Several periods of church history, including the Reformation, were characterized by a heightened apocalypticism in which the world's end seemed imminent. Lutheran hesitancy to include a developed apocalypticism in our theology may result from the fanaticism of the present revolt and now today's neo-evangelical preoccupation with Israel. Luther lacked this sensitivity. He found himself living in the last days, and his extravagant language in condemning the Jews and the papacy was apocalyptic. Without this understanding, some have concluded that Luther was anti-Semitic and overly critical of the papacy. Melanchthon attributed the reformer's hyperbole to a personality flaw, rather than seeing that Luther saw the events accompanying the Reformation as apocalyptic ones through which God was bringing a swift judgment against the papacy, the Jews, and the German populace for their rejection of the gospel, which God had allowed to shine through his Reformation. The last days were at hand. Alarms had to be sounded. Zwingli had fallen in battle. Charles V had sacked Rome. The outrageous immorality of the Anabaptist communities threatened to undo the Reformation and unravel the fibers which held society together. He saw himself sent before the great and terrible day of the Lord. The formula of Concord saw a removal of the gospel as final judgment. A missed opportunity. Millennialism, the idea that a serene kingdom will be established on earth in connection with Christ's return, and this brings up Professor Rass' lecture early this morning, belongs to our colonial heritage and peaked with President Woodrow Wilson's attempt to export the American dream with the League of Nations. Today's societal millenarianism does not awaken that fresh enthusiasm which greeted the 20th century. The timing is off. In theology, the precision of the moment counts for everything. Timing is like a diamond cutter striking the right fissure. Wycliffe, Savonarola, and Huss failed to be the reformers Luther became because the time was not right. Deference to the memory of John Huss indicates Luther's sense that God had put him in the world at the right time. Richard John Neuhaus notes, "We begin the new millennium without premillenarianism." Someone is... Oh, it's Dick. Oh, there's Dick. He knows your heart. A dawning millennial utopia in 1900 was followed by a war which brought apocalyptic horrors for the neo-orthodox Karl Barth and the confessional Hermann Sasse. World War II rekindled the fires of apocalyptic judgment. Christian Canaan lay in ashes. Her sons were dead. Paradise was lost. Then, in the 1970s, to accommodate Marxism, which fueled communism, the theology of hope and then the theology of revolution used futuristic themes to promote political agendas. Through Ernst Bloch's futuristic philosophy, Jürgen Moltmann drank of Hegel's philosophy, which looked to the future for final solutions. German theologians found a common philosophical basis to dialogue with communists. At first, the theology of hope was monergistic. God would deliver his people. And on its heels came an impatient theology of revolution, determined to bring about heaven on earth with revolution, a method particularly attractive to some Latin American priests, and in practice akin to the peasants' revolt and today's biblically motivated fanatics. The theologies of hope and revolution no longer occupy the lead position in theology upon which feminism has a weakening grasp. With the calendar as the Normand Normands, these futuristic theologies would have been perfectly suited for the year 2000. Had the theology of revolution been delayed a quarter of a century, it might have provided fanatical apocalypticism with a scholarly philosophical, theological base. In turn, the theology of revolution would have found willing soldiers to march under its banner. Reflective of the current lack of millennial interest are the meager selections of the major theological publishing house catalogs. The start of a new millennium provides a perfect opportunity to unveil the postmodern or third millennial man. Postmodernism is only a lightly veiled cynicism of which Erasmus was master, in which the 18th century Enlightenment figures turned into an entertaining, delightful art form. The lesson which is never learned is that the church should not adjust its message for the contemporary man, who is only a fleeting shadow, a bundle of unstable emotions, a succession of disconnected nerve endings, a conglomerate of foundationalist opinions, and in the end, a mental invention. His non-existence makes him capable of nothing else than a fictional description, and hence, he should not be addressed in our sermons as if he really existed. Lutherans should be embarrassed if we construct a gospel for the third millennium man that does not sound exactly like the one preached in the first century. Jesus, number seven. Jesus and the Son of Man, recovery of an old theme. An exception to the currently scholarly malaise greeting the third millennium is the apocalyptic Jesus. Bart D. Ehrman takes advantage of the millennium change to revive the theme that Jesus was an apocalyptic prophet who expected to be delivered by the mysterious Son of Man. A revolutionary Jesus with an apocalyptic agenda of bringing the kingdom of God on earth is perfectly suited for launching the new millennium. But unfortunately, this theme is so old, its shock value is lost. For those not in the scholarly know, Jesus was an apocalyptic prophet looking to further his revolutionary movement with help from the heavenly Son of Man, especially in delivering him from the agony of the cross. Instead, he died hopelessly, with no mysterious figure coming to his aid. Later, an anonymous but influential early church community erroneously concluded that Jesus was himself the Son of Man. Without critically analyzing their sources, the evangelists took this misidentification over into the Gospels. Since Albert Schweitzer's quest for the historical Jesus, this surgical separation of the Son of Man from Jesus has been standard scholarly fare. In the place of one Jesus as the Son of Man, scholars offer two figures, Jesus and the Son of Man. The apocalyptic card has been played too often for Ehrman's the apocalyptic Jesus to be startling. He serves leftovers with the elegance of a gourmet chef, but they are still leftovers. This theme of a revolutionary Jesus facing a hopeless death appeared in my favorite religious music. I just knew it so you guys can preach against somebody. Jesus Christ Superstar. No reference to the title of the president of this institution. The late notorious Bishop of Woolwich. Is that the way you pronounce that, Dr. Lever? Woolwich? What is it?
Woolwich.
Woolwich? I thought that's a place where you lived in a Woolwich. Remember back in Bronxville, the Germans would come over, you know, Bronxville Village? And they would say, they'd get the V's back to W's, Bronxville Village. A fascinating 20th century figure was the late John A.T. Robinson, erstwhile Anglican Bishop of Woolwich, and at death, a Cambridge Don. According to his acquaintances, I got this from Hartjust. He was an aristocratic and idiosyncratic loner. His deviations were a breath of fresh air in the world of the theologically predictable, whether it be of the orthodox or heterodox variety. If Luther's metaphor is of the drunken peasant falling off one side of a horse and then another, and I wish the Lutherans would get another metaphor, Robinson was like the pendulum of a fine clock set in an expensive oak casket, moving back and forth with graceful ease from outrageously liberal views to unforgivably conservative ones. His homage to God popularized the form criticism of Rudolf Bultmann and the neo-orthodoxy of Paul Tillich and Barth, and ushered in the God is dead theology of Thomas Altizer and William Hamilton. He was a progenitor of Joseph Fletcher's situation ethics. If Jesus did not really exist in the way the New Testament said he did, and if God was so far away from us to be outside the realms of ordinary communication, or so deep within the depths of human existence that he cannot be separated from it, then why not say so? Robinson did. And for his generation, God evaporated into a Barthian cloud and dissolved into a Tillichian fog. The bishop removed the let's pretend biblical dress from neo-orthodoxy and laid bare its principles by taking them to their logical conclusions. He prepared the world in which a God outside of us and a God inside of us would no longer exist. Then the pendulum swung right, and the bishop, now turned Cambridge scholar, published The Redating of the New Testament and The Priority of John. These publications consigned the darling of the left to the unredeemable right and eternally ostracized him from the fraternity of scholars. These books enjoyed no reviews, no second printings. He was ignored, a scholar's worst fear, and set adrift on an ice floe headed for warm waters. How far Robinson backed away from his former views about God is not known. But for confessional Lutherans, most Anglicans are among life's inscrutable mysteries. Robin looks as guilty as sin over there. Their liturgical form rarely translates into Orthodox belief. Clearly, the bishop underwent a conversion, but it is hard to say what it entailed. But nevertheless, a conversion it was. Perhaps he died as a subordinationist like Origen or Semi-Arian, but either fate was better than dying believing in the deity which emerged or was submerged in honest to God. In Jesus and His Coming, Robinson argued that Jesus expected the apocalyptic events about which he preached to happen in his own lifetime. These included the Son of Man sayings, which saw his death as divine judgment. These sayings were delivered at the end of Jesus' life and collected in Matthew's final or fifth discourse. The other evangelists, including the fourth, proceeded in the same way. In his last words, Jesus focused his predictive vision on his death and resurrection as the final apocalyptic event in which God would judge Israel for not believing in him. Robinson is careful not to deny a second coming, but sees it as an extension of Jesus' coming in judgment by death and resurrection. Quote, "For Jesus, the messianic act would certainly not be exhausted in his death and resurrection. On the contrary, the moment would release and initiate the right of God in which henceforth the Father's redeeming work could be brought to fulfillment which hitherto was denied. He called it inaugurated eschatology, a word which had been introduced previously in our symposium. Something different really happened with Jesus, death, and resurrection. After Easter, Christians projected his apocalyptic preaching into their future. But Jesus' future was his cross and resurrection. In recognizing the apocalyptic preaching of Jesus as a predictive description of his coming in judgment in his crucifixion and resurrection, and not merely in a distant event, the late bishop broke with the scholarly world. The need to date the composition of the Gospels after 70 was removed, and he could reassign traditional dates to the New Testament. Matthew and not Mark was the first, and may have been written as early as 40 and hardly later than 50. Also, the book of Revelation was probably written around the same time, the year 40. Paul's epistles were written after Matthew, and some after Luke. This was revolutionarily unacceptable for scholars, but redemptive for honest-to-God's author. The bishop often traveled wrong roads, but he ultimately arrived at the right destination in seeing that Jesus saw his death and resurrection as God's vindication of him. 9, a look at the evidence. Martin Kaler noted that the Gospels were the accounts of the death and resurrection of Jesus with introductions. He was right. The Gospels are not level playing fields, but a sense culminating in Jesus' death and resurrection. As each Gospel progresses, implicit references to death, and resurrection give way to explicit ones to prepare listeners for the actual events themselves. This is a reasonable but also demonstrable expectation. Each evangelist intends to make the final discourses authoritative, theological, interpretive preludes to his crucifixion and death, resurrection. Jesus is not Paul, but Jesus is the interpreter of his own death. In addition to editorial arguments just offered, that the last discourses are about what God will do through crucifixion and resurrection, Gethsemane gives us a rare picture into the mind of Jesus, who is obsessed not with a far-off return, but with the agony of his death and its meaning in God's plan of salvation. We should therefore expect to find in Jesus' final discourses, not predictions of a distant fantastic future, and that's the problem of millennialism and a lot of Lutherans, but parables of his death and resurrection, and we are not disappointed. Millennialism, the belief in an earthly Jewish kingdom, relies on passages in Jesus' last discourses, especially Matthew 23, 36. Truly I say to you, all this will come upon this generation. In 24, 34. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away till all these things take place. Generation is understood as a prediction, among Lutherans too, as a prediction that the Jews will remain a people until Christ's return. However, all Matthew's uses of generation refer to his contemporaries who heard and in most cases rejected Jesus, and not to the race of Jews. These passages can no more be used to support the state of Israel than anti-Semitism. Jesus preaches in the style of the prophets, so that the predictive word embraces the future through current events. Prophetic predictions were not verbal abstractions, but took on life in extraordinary historical occurrences or natural events experienced by the hearers. Occurrences then became the lens through which future generations understood the events they would encounter. Deliverance through the Red Sea held out promise of a greater future deliverance. Nathan's promise to David that Solomon would build a temple extended to Jesus as the final temple, a claim for which he was sentenced to execution. Paul expanded the idea of temple to include believers. Jesus saw Israel's history, past history, coming to reality in his time. In turn, Jesus' predictions fulfilled during his ministry stretched into the future and shaped it. Matthew conveniently gathers the crucifixion apocalyptic events into 27 verses 50 through 53. They are the following. 1, the shout of triumph. 2, the release of the Holy Spirit. 3, the tearing of the temple curtain from the top to the bottom. 4, the earthquake. 5, the splitting rocks. 6, the opening sepulchres. 7, the resurrection of the sleeping bodies of the saints. 8, their entering the holy city after Christ's resurrection. And 9, their appearance to many. Add to these 10, the darkness covering the earth, verse 45, and 11, the first cry, which is described as a bellowing shock, verse 46. By two editorial devices, the evangelist ties the crucifixion to the resurrection as sides of one event. 1, the report of the resurrection of the dead is contained within the account of the crucifixion, but the resurrected saints appear in the holy city only after Jesus' resurrection, 27:53. Even though the complete account of the resurrection first comes in chapter 28. And 2, accompanying the resurrection is an earthquake, 28:2, which recalls the one attached to the crucifixion, or it may be the same one, 27:54. Earthquakes, splitting rocks, and the four events connected with the resurrection of the saints are recognizably apocalyptic. Jesus' triumphant shouts are not those of a helpless victim, but of the victorious Emmanuel, God with us, who carries out judgment on the enemies of his people. Earth-covering darkness fulfills the prediction of 24:29. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and suggests the pericope in which this passage is located finds a full focus in the death of Jesus. His death is in every way the world-shattering event. It is apocalyptic, defines apocalyptic, and is the quintessential of apocalyptic. The identification of events accompanying the crucifixion as apocalyptic is secured by the response of those who are with the centurion, who saw the earthquake and what took place, and they were filled with awe and said, truly, this was the Son of God. In his crucifixion, the Son of Man had come with power and glory as he promised the high priest. And Gentiles, that is Romans, and not God's covenant people, that is the Jews, recognize it. Not only is the cross surrounded with these apocalyptic phenomena, but the cross itself is the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. The one apocalyptic event which spectacularly exceeds all others. Here he is lifted up and draws all men to himself. The cross is an historical event, but more. It is proclamatory judgment against those who rejected him and is appropriately accompanied by events associated with the last days. His executioner and all who reject him shall look upon him whom they have pierced. Two passages which are not generally, if at all, seen as Christological references. I guess that's not a sentence. Oh well. Well, two passages are not generally, if at all, seen as Christological references. Matthew 24:28, where the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together, is understood as an example. Dead flesh attracts vultures. That is, people take advantage of bad situations. But does this meaning fit? The proper translation is, where the corpse is, there the eagles gather. English translations hamper the full intent of this passage by using body and carcass instead of corpse, and vultures instead of eagles. The sensus literalis, notice that Lutheran note, the sensus literalis is more productive. Around Jesus' corpse gather eagles mounted as insignia on Roman military standards. Then follows the prediction of a darkness encircling the earth and the sign of the Son of Man, which is the cross. Another reference pointing to the cross as the apocalyptic event is 24:15. So when you see the desolating sacrilege spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Scholars refer to the setting up of the emperor's statue in the temple. Understanding the holy place as the temple runs totally counter to Jesus' claim that he is the temple. Appropriately, Christians transferred allegiance to Jesus and soon lost interest in the Jerusalem building. Also, Matthew sees no redeeming value in the city which rejected Jesus, for whom its temple was no longer a house of prayer, but a den of robbers. Jerusalem hardly qualifies as the holy city into which the resurrected saints enter. The evangelist adds an instructive rubric intended for the liturgical reader. Let the reader understand. Understand what? Abruptly, the elector, now by the way, the Bible is not intended for private reading when it was written. This is a rubric to be used in a church service. Abruptly, the elector, that's the guy who reads the scriptures, by the way, is alerted. Around here, I guess we call him Art, anyway, this morning. Art. Title of his autobiography. Abruptly, the lector is alerted that the desolating sacrilege is something very important, arguably the most important something in the gospel. This and the Markan parallel are the only occurrences of this kind of a rubric. The very important something can hardly be the emperor's statue. Jesus was as indifferent to the emperor as he was to the temple, as were the early Christians who were urged to honor him. Why should Christians care if his statue were erected in the temple, which continued to reject Jesus? If Paul can speak of the crucified Jesus as a curse for us, then the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place can describe the cross placed in Golgotha. At the heart of our religion is that Christ as the sinner is an abomination to God. This Jesus recognizes in his cry of dereliction, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? By adding where it ought not to be, before let the reader understand, Mark provides a further interpretation that God ought not to be at Golgotha. But he is. Let the reader understand. Not only is the fullness of the deity present and revealed in the ignominy of the cross, but it is. The cross is the only place where the sinner can find God. Where Jesus contrasts abomination with the holy place, Paul, in describing the cross, contrasts folly and wisdom, and in it he glories. Paul's fully developed theology of the cross clearly has Jesus as its source. Absence of the ascension in Matthew is crucial to understanding how the evangelist focus God's judgment in Jesus' death and resurrection. Matthew does not move beyond crucifixion and resurrection to the ascension, as does Luke, who has two accounts of it. By including angels at the ascension, Luke sees it as theologically spectacular, as Christ's conception, birth, and resurrection, in all of which angels are prominent. Where Luke includes the promise of Jesus' return, Acts 1, Matthew has no departure of Jesus, and accordingly, Jesus does not promise to return. The one who is perpetually with his followers cannot return. Lo, I am with you to the end of the age. Judgment has been carried out on those who knew his promise to destroy and build the temple was a reference to his death and resurrection. His accusers knew that the charge that Jesus would destroy government property, which was a capital crime, was bogus. And after they succeeded in having Jesus crucified, they take steps to prevent a fabricated resurrection. When a real resurrection happens, they package it as body theft. Since his opponents fully understood that Jesus' parable spoke of his death and resurrection, and then took steps to stop his program, they face a certain condemnation. Apocalyptic judgment plays a prominent role in all Jesus' preaching and is introduced by Matthew as early as the genealogy and the birth narrative, where the slaughter of the infants brings into the present Jerusalem's destruction by the Babylonians and anticipates a greater one. God's judgment on Israel concludes in Jesus' death and resurrection, which together are two sides of the one divine event. Resurrection is as necessary as death, and to locate importance on either side of the one divine act at the expense of the other does an injustice at one level to the biblical text and at another level to the divine plan itself. 10. Neo-evangelicals and higher critics as allies. Since for neo-evangelicals, the apocalyptic passages point to Israel, on that account, Larry Rast's essay was extremely helpful. Neo-evangelicals have a vested interest in not identifying them with Christ's death and resurrection. At the root of their aberrant interpretation is not the non-use or misuse of objective hermeneutical principles, which you may have learned at this institution, but a Christological deficiency in biblical interpretation. Critical scholars are not likely to follow neo-evangelical conclusion that the final discourses point to Israel and the premillennial return of Christ. But their historical critical methods discount the miraculous, and at best, Jesus' resurrection is only a retrojection of the church's Easter faith back into his life. Simply put, the church believed he rose from the dead, but as an historical event, it is unprovable. Since his resurrection is historically problematic, his return is hardly imminent. Alleged predictions were read back after they happened into the mouth of Jesus. The king's order to destroy the city of the invited guests who did not attend his feast, Matthew 22, is regarded as an historical allegory of the Roman destruction of Jerusalem. This supports the majority view that the Gospels could not have been written before 70. In spite of different methods and goals, conservative neo-evangelicals and liberal scholars agree that the apocalyptic discourses attributed to Jesus are not descriptions of his crucifixion and resurrection. Paragraph 11, Bach got it right. Artists and composers are often better biblical interpreters than preachers and scholars. The doctrine of the universal priesthood means that scriptures are too important to be left to the often arbitrary and contrived hermeneutical rules whose authority rests on the orthodox pedigree of their proponents, or the incessantly changing criteria proposed by historical critics. Artists have the advantage of placing on one canvas items and events which take theologians several chapters to unpack. It is easier to paint the crucifixion and resurrection on one canvas belonging to one event, which it is for God, than it is to explain how the cross's humiliation is the moment of Christ's exaltation, or that the resurrected Lord remains the crucified Jesus. This Paul understood. Similarly, Peter's death glorifies God. In addressing the emotions with the intellect, composers involve more of the human nature. A mighty fortress sung rouses the troops for battle. Recited at the end of a sermon, it goes flat. Musicians have at least four parts which blend different themes into one unified message. Johann Sebastian Bach, the 250th anniversary of whose death we are commemorating at this symposium, often could use two choruses and hence eight parts. He was Luther's faithful disciple, perhaps the most faithful one, in handling the themes of death and resurrection in his cantatas, including the one offered yesterday afternoon by the Scholus Cantorum. Gottes Zeit ist die allerbeste Zeit, or Komm sie's tot, or Chris Lagen totus bande. His St. Matthew and St. John's Passion concentrate on interpreting Christ's death chiefly, but not only, from a human perspective, which may account for its appeal even among unbelievers. Such devotees of Bach's Passions do the Lutheran thing in taking the first step to God by approaching him in the utter desperateness of Christ's humanity. But they do not take the determinative second step by stepping through an agonizing death into the redemptive and apocalyptic significance of that death. For Lutherans and all believers, this is unintelligible tragedy. Bach recognizes that the evangelists see Christ's death as the proclamation of his divinity. And in this, he sees what the theologians often do not see. In the St. Matthew Passion, he concludes the apocalyptic significance of the death of Jesus, Matthew 27, 51, 53, and then later he transposes it into the St. John Passion. In this death scene, the contralto aria introduces the Christus Victor theme, the hero from Judah has triumphed in strength. Then the tenor sings Matthew 27, 51, 53, with the ripping of the temple veil, the quaking earth, and the resurrection of the saints. All this is accompanied by running up and down the keys of a clavichord to approximate God's opening up the earth in judgment. In the St. Matthew Passion, this is accompanied by a bass fiddle. At least that's what it sounds like to me. Inclusion of Matthew 27, 51 into the St. John's Passion appears at first to be an alien intrusion into this gospel. However, Matthew's apocalyptic resurrection of the saints corresponds with Christ's words in John, "For the hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come forth." Robinson, Bishop Robinson, correctly notes this about John's description of the crucifixion. In the single redemptive act, that is, the act of the cross, God glorifies the Son. In it, Jesus is exalted and ascends, and in it, the Spirit is given. The Passion is the decisive, the eschatological moment when the world is judged and the end is reached and all things are finished. A more detailed study of Jesus' final discourses as apocalyptic interpretative predictions of his death and resurrection, rather than that of far distant future events, deserves more attention. Here I intended only to introduce the topic within the climate afforded by the turn of the millennium, and to indicate its possibilities for biblical interpretation, theology, and preaching, and to offer certain correctives. For this, I am in debt to Johann Sebastian Bach's interpretive music and John A.T. Robinson's courage to break with the scholarly flock and to understand the apocalyptic words of Jesus within the context of his redemptive death. Tribute is also due to the friendship of the late Anglican scholar Christopher Stephen Mann, who opened a window of biblical interpretation through which I have only recently looked.